Hey, listeners, are you getting inspired to dive deeper into your learning of EFFT? If so, head on over to Catherine's website to check out her list of upcoming trainings. Some trainings are focused on combining EFFT with young kids and EFFT play therapy. So head on over to her website and we hope to see you in the future. Check it out at katherinedebruin.com, katherinedebruin.com, and we hope to see you in the future.
Welcome to the Family Express podcast, where our destination is resilient and connected families. Come aboard with your hosts, marriage and family therapists, Katherine DeBruin and Rhonda Evans, to explore the world of emotionally focused family therapy, a model developed by Sue Johnson and colleagues. Together with our guest speakers, our travels will map the EFFT landscape, highlighting lessons learned, shared fears, and the passion and curiosity that bonds our community.
Welcome back, listeners, to the next episode of the Family Express podcast with Katherine DeBruin and Rhonda Evans. We're here today talking with Lori Branch, a clinician out in Colorado, and we're so grateful to have you here, Lori. We're going to be talking about working with families and teens, screen time, gaming, electronics, and how families are impacted by those interactions. Lori, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here with you today.
Thank you so much. We're excited to learn from you and talk with you about these topics. Let's start with, how did you get into family work, working with families?
So my entry into the field was a small nonprofit, and it was for teen substance abusers. And our motto was, if you want to use drugs, that's your problem. And if you want to stop, that's, you know, we can help you with that. And so we had a lot of self-referred teens that came to the program that heard about it. It was free for them. And we also hosted a parent group. Many of the parents did not come to those meetings. So that brought a red flag up for me. I wondered about it. When the teens asked me to host a Thanksgiving dinner one year, that really raised an alarm for me. I thought, gosh, you know, even though I was not a mom myself, and I was pretty young at the time in my 20s, I felt like there was something pretty seriously wrong, that the families didn't, you know, have some level of wanting their teen to be there at the family Thanksgiving. Like, that was, I thought, a pretty major thing. So then I became more interested in family work and couples work as a result, thinking, wow, if we could help the couples, maybe they would raise kids that would be more securely attached and wouldn't want to turn to drugs and alcohol during those times in their lives. And so it started a whole, like a snowball rolling down the hill for me. I began to look more into couples work discovered EFT, of course. And that was really like the first time I ever saw Sue Johnson was in Denver. And I thought, this is it. This is an answer to so much of what I've been wondering about for a long time. Mm.
Lori, I'm so grateful that you're here with us today. It's so nice to see you again. And I'm super curious, like, why are we seeing more? Are we seeing more addiction amongst kids and teenagers? And why do you think that could be the case? I'm thinking particularly about screen addiction with the availability of that now. What are you noticing? What trends are you seeing?
Yeah, well, what I'm seeing is since the pandemic, I think that there's been so many changes again in the family and having to adjust and readjust to our circumstances has been challenging. You know, I didn't grow up with a cell phone. I don't know what that's like, right? And it's such a norm. And it's very, you know, and I see adults all the time as well. I mean, so we're on our devices as well as the kids being on devices, and it's a connection. Many years ago, when I first started this work and first started family work, I remember a mom and daughter, and they would call each other. They would talk on the phone from the house, and it wasn't a cell phone. It was a regular phone. They had two lines. And that's how they connected, right? And so we're looking for ways, how can we connect and what disconnects us, right? And parents and teens often get into these negative dynamics with each other around the power struggle, around the devices. Right. Mm-hmm. And this has been going on, I think, for a long time. There's a dopamine hit, right, that happens. And so it's definitely something that I think we're still trying to research what's going on, right? There's a lot of research coming out about the brain and what, you know, what's needed, but what we know as EFT clinicians is that attachment and bonding is really important. And so having, I think one of the beauties about living in Colorado is we do have a lot of families that love the outdoors, right? For instance, so I think that can be really nurturing and nourishing for families to get out and go camping where there's no connection. And I do hear that from families where they'll say, yes, you know, when the devices aren't there, it's a whole different experience, right?
Interesting.
Yeah.
So we're talking about sort of the quality of life and family relationships, and we're in mm-hmm. a world now where screens and devices are just a very big part of our lives.
And right, even school, right?
Teaching our kids how to regulate themselves around media is mm-hmm. now a big part of parenting that never maybe used to be a part of it. And
right. And
you're saying you either see families where kids are really overusing media and devices, potentially because there's a dopamine hit, so there's a high level of addiction, or mm-hmm. they're trying to get away from it entirely and get out into the open and then mm-hmm. noticing that the quality of their conversations is entirely different based
right.
on where they are.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
That's so interesting. So do you have a lot of families come in with this being the problematic sort of the presenting problem, their kids using screens and how to manage that?
It seems to be, you know, what I see with the girls is more the social media piece, right? Their Instagram accounts, and in some way, Boulder is a very beautiful place with beautiful people, right? And so, you know, we see girls who are really comparing themselves to one another, and, you know, there's bullying that happens, right? So it's loaded. I mean, I think that's one of the things that I really notice is that the gaming seems to be more with the boys, at least that's what I've seen. And then the social media and the likes that they're looking for, right? Another kind of approval and really looking to get validated from peers, right? Which is a normal part of the development of teens. And, you know, I think there's a lack, too, of some of the social skills, right? Like they don't, you know, they don't really have to have that face to face. And
yeah,
and it's missing, right? The parental attunement. And yeah, that's the word I would use. It's loaded, right? There's so many traps and so many ways in which kids can end up feeling worse about themselves, and the heightened anxiety and depression that we see is quite, you know, it's quite high. And in a competitive place like Boulder, it's, you know, we have a lot of, you know, the good news is that parents have resources, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But the bad news is there's a sense of entitlement that happens, I think, and this escape, right? People are looking to
yes.
escape.
Lori, can I tell you about, you're making me think about a moment I just had this weekend. Can I tell you?
Yes, I want to hear it.
I think it illustrates what you're talking about. I feel like in our little family, we don't have a ton of support, you know, because we're an immigrant family. And my husband and I are both working pretty long hours. And I would say that we're kind of preoccupied even when we're at home. And our stress levels are a little high at the moment. And so our three almost teenagers, when they're not at school or doing extramurals, they're often watching TV and just sort of zoning out. And we allow that because we're so exhausted. And so on Sundays, though, we do have this tech-free day. No one's allowed to be on tech. But, I mean, I like the idea of it, but then the kids start being so annoying because they're bored. And then I feel like I have to entertain them. And I just really want to chill out. And, you know, I have my own ideas of what I want to do on a Sunday to chill out. So this mm-hmm. Sunday, the kids were especially bored and I was just frustrated. And I was like, okay, let's just get out and go do something as a family. And then we got out, but then it's like we couldn't settle and just enjoy the activity. And so I started really beating myself up as a mom and thinking, it's like we don't know how to do this now because we spend so much of the week working hard or, you know, mm-hmm. kind of self-regulating with tech. And it's like we've lost our ability to just relax and enjoy tech-free time. And mm-hmm. so I got super frustrated and I had to talk myself off a little emotional panic ledge.
Mm.
Realized, you know what, I could get upset with the kids and blame them for being bored and not knowing how to handle themselves without tech, or I could recognize that, hey, we've just lost our equilibrium and I really want to slow down and have a more simple life, not have too much stress, so that when we do have time available, I have energy and I want to play family games and I want to go on a hike and enjoy time together so that I have something to give, you know?
Right.
That's what happened to me. And I'm just curious, is that the kind of thing you're seeing? And yeah, what do you make of that?
Definitely. I mean, I definitely see that because, I think you're right. Like a lot of teenagers, they don't know what to do. And, you know, first of all, I wanted to say, wow, a tech-free day, like a whole day of tech-free, you know,
that
like
sounds so hard.
That sounds hard and amazing. And even just like the intention of that, like we want, you know, right? Like what kind of support? What I'm wondering about is how that came out, even in the family discussion. Like how did you just decide we're going to have a family? Did you and your spouse decide that? Or what was the conversation like to even put that out there in your family? I just think it's really
hard. I mean, I'm not sure if I've talked about this on the podcast before, but I think we might have a somewhat unusual outlook. And it's probably because my husband's in tech. Okay. So we're not going to be one of those tech-free households because tech is just, we always have the latest tech because that's just his big part of his world. Right. Sure. So we have this philosophy that our kids are part of a tech world. We want them to be really good at tech because that's where a lot of the jobs are going in the future. Mm-hmm. So we want to teach our children how to regulate.
Right.
From an early age. So if they can learn to regulate themselves, they can use as much tech as they want to. I don't know if they use tech as long as they're getting good marks at school, they're socially engaging, they're in the extramurals. And I'd rather have them be on tech for half an hour and then know how to say stop and get off it than simply not using tech or me constantly structuring it.
Exactly. Yeah,
and that makes sense. So part of that, those have been conversations we've had in our family from the very beginning.
and
teaching them how to regulate themselves and learning how to, if they can't regulate themselves because one of them is neurodiverse, how do you put an alarm clock on for your 30-minute, you know, amount? And then when the alarm goes off, you take yourself off of that iPad and you put that iPad away. And so part of that discussion was just, let's also do a tech-free day so that we can also learn what life looks like when you're bored and how to get through that and be more creative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's, you know, it sounds good. You know, it's good that you're going for that. So,
what kind of conversations are you having with families, like around
that?
Media addiction or usage?
Yeah. So, you know, really trying to look at what happens with the parents when, you know, when the kid can't regulate, when they can't stop, right? You know, then that's when it becomes a problem. And
some kids have a really hard time with that, right? You know?
Yes.
But some kids who are like maybe neurodiverse and are dopamine seeking, that's really hard to stop, right?
It's really hard. Yes. And so then we have parents who like jump in and they turn everything off or they get angry, right? And they escalate and then the family escalates and the negative pattern can get pretty rigid with that.
You're saying,
right?
it starts not only being a problem with screens, then it starts being a relationship problem.
Exactly, because the parents get exasperated, right? And then the child feels frustrated and they're, you know, in some cases, it really goes to an extreme, right? Where the child is supposed to be doing homework, for instance, on the tech, right? But they're not. They're gaming, right? And so then we have an honesty issue that pops into that equation. And then the parents are hovering and being, you know, really worried about like what's the long-term effects. And
it's so easy to get into a negative pattern around this. Because I know like, for me over the weekend, like I see the problem. They don't know how to spend time off tech. Then I start feeling bad as a parent. Then I get into my own shame and my anxiety about what this means for the future of my kids, what this means for me as a mom.
And the worry.
And it's so easy for me to take my bad mood out on them and get upset with them, frustrated, grouchy with them.
Right.
And then the more I do that, the worse they start feeling about their tech usage. Mm-hmm. But then the worse they feel, the more they want to tune out and use tech.
Exactly.
And
yes.
then they do that, but then they lie about it and hide it. And then it becomes a worse issue, right? And it just goes on and around and around.
Right. That's, you just named it right there. And that's, you know, that's one of the things that I've seen, particularly with neurodiverse kids, for sure. You know, I see that it's a connection, like these games, the gaming, it's some kind of connection, right? And they feel like, you know, if it's a place that they're getting success and validated, right, that they feel like they're good at it, then it becomes, that's the seeking, right? That's part of that, you know, like I want more of this, I want more of this. And then with between the parental shame and what happens in between for the child feeling bad about themselves too, then, you know, that it's a spiral down for sure. And it really causes a lot of pain and distress in families.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So then are you two talking about now that the pattern has been named, now we're helping families by saying it's not a screen problem. It's a pattern problem. The pattern is key.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think that's really important to talk about what's happening to each person and for the parents to really start listening more because they have their point of view. They want to get through to their teen. But if they don't, if the teen doesn't feel met, then it's not, you know, it's not going to really get through. Right. Mm-hmm. So that is, it's so important for us to try to understand that teen world. What is that like for, you know, what are they, what needs are they getting met there? The acceptance, the belonging, whatever that be, you know, that they're not getting maybe in their families or at school or whatever other, you know, they have a whole life outside of us. And we do need to really see, well, what is it like for them? You know, really try to understand deeply what their experience is.
Listeners, check out our book for children, children of any age. It's called A Jumble of Thoughts and a Tangle of Feelings. It's on Amazon.com. If you know a child out there who is having a tough time, but unable to put that distress into words, this book is your guide to helping them figure out what is going on. Whether you're an educator, a therapist, or a parent, we really think this will be a helpful guide for you. So you're saying, Lori, that there ends up being two issues, right? The screen or social media usage, and then the relational issue in the family. And parents, if the relationship isn't strong enough, parents aren't going to be able to move that child or have input or have the conversations to understand what does that screen usage give the kiddo? Like what emotional needs are being met by that?
Right.
So that we can come alongside our teen and have a conversation about how to get those needs met differently or
right,
like be an ally with them on how to manage this usage.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's not a matter of just taking it away. It's a matter of understanding either socially, emotionally, or in the brain, like, why is this so important for you right now? What is it getting you?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Getting curious and sort of exploring that with your team is like a together problem, right?
Yes. The openness and the curiosity, I think, is really important. And for us to stay regulated too, you know, as parents, because we can get exasperated by that negative cycle and the brain development, right? The teen might not really see that it's going to affect them, that there are going to be consequences. You know, for instance, if they're choosing gaming over doing their schoolwork and that sort of thing, right? Parents get very worried about this. The anxiety can come up. You know, what's going to happen? You're not making it. You don't seem to be engaged in school. Yeah. So there's so many implications that it's pretty complicated. Yeah.
And as a parent or caregiver, like sharing the why, sharing what our concerns are, right? This isn't just about us shutting down access to social life. Like, why are we so worried about this? Like, what do we think it's doing to your brain? Or why would this get in the way of your future? Or being able to explain that to the teenager is important too. So that it doesn't just fall in a place of them thinking my parents are trying to make life hard for me.
Right. Well, and you know, it reminds me, Catherine, as you're talking about that, many years ago, I taught an alcohol diversion class for the city of Boulder. And this was a class that I had to do for parents and teens when a teen got busted at a party, right? And so there'd be a party with drinking. And then one way that it would go off their record would be to attend this class. And let me tell you, you did not want to be in that very first class with the teens who did not want to be there and the parents who were so mad that they had to be there. But one of the things I think by the end, it was a 4-class series. And by the end of it, we did this exercise with the parents where we talked about if you're kiddo continues with the alcohol use, what hopes and dreams do you have for your teen that might get extinguished by their using drugs and alcohol? Like what? And so it gave the parent really an opportunity. It was certainly my favorite part of the class because they were able to look them in the eye and share with them, these are the things I really want for you, right? Yeah. And in a really explicit way. And these are the very things I worry, you know, like sharing our concern and our love coming from that place. It also hits on the parental intention too, right? Which can kind of help calm the parents down. So, yeah.
So you're making a really important point right now, Lori, for our listeners is, first of all, you're just slowing it down. Like I hear in your voice, you're just going slower. And you're saying behind the parent getting on the teen, the parent is scared. They're scared about their teen's future, potential lost opportunities. That fear is understandable. And we have to link how parents responding to the parent's fear, because it's by exploring the parent's fear that we can start finding their caregiving intent. And right. It can help the teenager see that the reason your parent is coming down on you in this way is because they are scared, and they're scared because they care.
Mm-hmm.
Have to find that caregiving intent
right.
in the parent's behavior. Otherwise, it just can fall in a harmful place for the teenager who is going to fill it in a different way, right? In a possibly more negative way of why their parents taking away the very thing that's meeting an important need for them.
Right.
Right. So we actually have to balance what they're getting.
Yes.
And we have to weigh it up with here's your parents' intention that's right. really trying to give you something very important.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And helping them to make sense of it all, because when they're in a negative pattern with each other and not connecting, then, you know, it becomes, you know, for the teen, they feel so unseen sometimes and unattended to, right? And so as caregivers, I think what you're saying is exactly right, Catherine, for us to be able to name it out loud and be explicit so that there's a better understanding. Right. And that message of I care, I love you, I'm here for you.
So we want to be able to explore what's going on inside the teenager's mind in terms of what they're getting out of it and needing. But right. we're also making space in that family session to really understand what's behind the scenes for the parents and where's exactly. fear coming from, where's this motivation coming from. We're slowing the whole conversation down to away from the urgency of there's this behavior that's out of control. And, oh my goodness. And like, let's just talk a little more about what's behind the scenes. And right. I know that you have a secret weapon.
Yes.
You have a secret weapon. Tell us how you slow things down in your office.
Yeah. Well, so I'll tell you how I got started with that too. I was an intervention specialist in two middle schools. And one day I was doing a grief group for the middle schoolers. Several of them had a major loss in their lives, a grandparent, one had a sibling loss, one had a parent loss. And so we had this group. And one day a cat wandered into the group. And it was the best group we ever had because the kids took turns holding. It was a very cuddly cat. So my supervisor said, well, Lori, did you invite the cat in for the next session? Because they really finally started opening up. And I had a friend who was very involved in San Diego, actually, with Canine Companions for Independence. And she was a breeder and puppy raiser. And so I chatted with her and I said, I think a dog would be great to work with kids. And she said, well, you can get on a list for released dogs. And at the time, they really looked for people who were going to use the dogs in some kind of work. So that was my very first experience with having a therapy dog. And now I have my fourth dog, and we're a graduate team. So I have legal public access with Yasmina, who is a facility dog from Canine Companions for Independence. So she's highly trained. She's highly attuned. And it's just very, very helpful to have her in the room as a co-regulator for people. Of course, the teens love her. The adults love her too. I have people who sit on the floor with her. And a few of the neurodiverse kids in particular really gravitate towards the dog, and they may spend their time just petting her, which she just loves, you know. So she has like a perfect job and a perfect role in my office. And, you know, we've gone out on walks. I have one teenager who had a ferret, and I said, oh, it would be very helpful. My dog has never met a ferret before. It would be really helpful in her training if you could bring your ferret in sometime. So she brought the ferret. You know, this is about meeting people where they are, right? And so I do see Yasmina as my secret weapon. And, you know, she definitely knows how the alliance, it can really help with the alliance. And it can also help with adding some humor sometimes to the sessions. And she loves everyone. So she doesn't discriminate, which is great. She'll go to each person in the family, and it's really a gift, really, to have such a highly trained dog that can, you know, it kind of tells me some things too diagnostically when I look and see what a person's reaction to the dog is and what their attachment is and how they, you know, I used to call her with couples, I used to call her my withdrawer re-engager. Because she really knew how to engage people in that way. She'll come up and she'll put her head on your lap, for instance, and just look deeply into your eyes. So it's a really nice way of having that co-therapist with me, who's non-judgmental, who loves and brings out joy and playfulness as well. Yeah, it's really a wonderful thing.
That's so cool. That's so cool how it started. It sounds like the way you describe it, like a happy accident. It's like it started that way. But yeah, I just think it's so great how you can how it can facilitate the alliance and facilitate attachment and connection right there in your session. And it's so funny, like I never thought about doing it with families. I've only envisioned it in my head with just using it for individual therapy. So thanks for opening up my eyes of how to think of it differently and more systemically. So thanks, Lori. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course.
Lori, yeah. Along these lines, we're seeing more service animals being used, I think, in emotional support animals. Mm-hmm. Are you noticing that as well? And is that something you recommend for families, like to have their own?
Yeah, there are some distinctions that I will mention because it's a different emotional support animals are different than service animals. So I will say that service animals have legal public access that is different, right? So now they're starting to crack down some on the emotional support animals, because some of them are not that. I mean, you can get a vest online that says service animals, you know, service dog, or and that sort of thing. And I've had friends who have service dogs that are needed because they live in a wheelchair and their dogs really help them with physical needs that they might have. And sometimes the fraudulent dogs have attacked, you know, the service dogs. And so it, you know, it has become a problem. Emotional support animals, usually you would have to get some kind of permission. You know, if you're dwelling, you know, if your apartment building or wherever you're renting from, if you're not a homeowner, there's question over whether you would have legal access to have, you'd have to check with your landlord on that. So there are different rules. Mm-hmm. And I think it's super helpful to have an emotional support animal for people that have PTSD. They're using CCI now is having, they've done kind of a pilot program with veterans and having PTSD dogs. So they have special skills that if a person was, if is having flashbacks or some kind of dissociative state, the dogs will come in and help regulate them. Like they may lay across their lap or do perform certain things. And so there's all different categories now, right? There's therapy dogs and there's service dogs and emotional support animals. And then, you know, years ago, I did a read program at my kids' elementary school with my dog to help second graders learn, you know, to second graders who were struggling with reading. It was like a read to the dog program. It was lovely. But that was, you know, that was requested by the school. So I wouldn't have had legal public access there. And since I don't have any kind of physical disability or emotional disability, I have public access with my dog when I have a client with me, for instance.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, Lori, thank you so much for chatting to us today about some of the kinds of families that you're seeing in practice. Mm-hmm. And speaking a little bit to just the unique parenting challenges we face in today's world.
Right.
And the importance of slowing down and helping families have conversations about some of the worries that come up, right? About our kids just spending too much time on screens and with social media. Both, we really need to be able to meet them where they are and understand their emotional needs, what's why they feel the importance of being a part of that world. And then working together with them by having a good relationship, being able to work on this together, making adjustments that can be good for their brains.
And getting support, you know, getting support and being resourced, getting resources if you need them, having, you know, having a team of people who you can reach out to.
Yeah.
Really important to be able to just shore each other up. It takes a village, as they say. I think that's true.
Yes, for sure. We need to help each other out because we don't have as much support as we used to have, and the world looks very, very different.
Exactly.
Glad to know you're out there doing what you're doing.
Thank you. Take care, you too. It was really nice to meet you, Rhonda.
Thank you, Lori.
Alrighty, bye-bye.
That's it for today, folks. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you again for our next journey.